So today's Taisho will be on case 47 in the Blue Cliff Record, the Heikigan Roku. Case 47 is entitled Umongs Beyond the Six. Engo's introduction. Heaven never speaks, yet the four seasons follow their courses. Earth does not talk, but all things prosper. Where the four seasons follow their courses, you can see the substance. Where all things prosper, you can find the use. Now tell me, where do you see the monk? Stop your speech, your actions, your daily routine, and closing your lips and throat, say it. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is the Dharmakaya? Umon said, beyond the six. Secho's verse, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The blue-eyed Indian monk cannot count it. Rashly, they say Shorin passed it on to Shinko, or he, clad in the robe, journeyed back to India. India is vast and far. He is not to be found. Lo, since last night, he has been here facing Nyoho. Well, I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning and sitting so well. Really wonderful to practice with you all. If you're online, can you hear me okay? Yes? Okay, good. Right. So this is one of those koans that requires a great deal of clearing away in order to be open to where it wants you to go, where it wants to take you. It might be helpful to know that the Dharmakaya is the classical Indian word, the classical Sanskrit word for enlightened mind. So the idea is that at the core of your consciousness, at the core of your mind, there's this enlightened awareness, this radiant, compassionate, enlightened awareness. And in a classical Buddhist thinking, this is called the Dharmakaya. Kaya means body, right? And Dharma means Buddhist teaching. So you could translate it as Buddha body, Buddha body. So a monk asked Umon, what is the Dharmakaya? What is the Dharmakaya? And as usual, you know, monks, Zen masters don't do what I just did. They don't say, oh, well, in ancient Indian thinking, that was the word for the, means, you know, body of the Buddha, Buddha body, etc. It means enlightened mind. Umon, like Joshu in the koan Mu, when Joshu is asked about whether a dog has Buddha nature, when asked about the Dharmakaya, Umon doesn't provide like a discursive instruction. He shows the monk the way, how to get there, how to get there. So it doesn't really do much good to define it. It does a lot of good if you can show somebody how to find it, how to find it. So, you know, I think right now it's a difficult period for all kinds of reasons. But one of the reasons is that people are, you know, we're sort of like awash in information. I'm not the first person to point this out. But, you know, I teach English, and when I come into my classroom, You know, most of my students are on their phone. And they're really absorbed, you know. Sometimes I actually have to like clap my hands to get them to look up. They're so absorbed at whatever they're looking at. Maybe it's a TikTok or a reel on Facebook. I'm not sure. But they're just like oblivious to everything else. And this practice is this state of mind, I think has really become more prevalent, maybe than ever before. Books, right? Like cheap, inexpensive books, were hard to get at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, paperback books were this new innovation. You might have heard the phrase a dime store paperback, right? Well, you know, into the early 20th century, books were like expensive items. Only elite people had books in their home. Wealthy, powerful people had prestigious libraries. You know, in the years between World War I and World War II, somebody had the idea of making a paperback book, right? And they could be printed really cheaply. They could be printed on newspaper print, actually, not like nice paper, but the paper people print newspapers on, sort of a cheap, rough, pulpy paper. And they began to crank out mass market paperback books. And everybody started reading books, right? It was like a revolution. When I was a kid, I could get a cheap Ace science fiction book. It was paperback Ace science fiction for like 25 cents. In fact, I think it was even cheaper than that, you know. So I could buy a book at the drugstore or some other places. There was a bookstore. And I could fill up on my reading list for a dollar. You know, I could come away with five books for a dollar or something like that. I would read. When I would read, I was a lot like my students with their cell phones. You know, so I was as a kid, I was kind of an introvert, and I wasn't very good at sports, but I love to read. And so, you know, my idea of a good time might be to, you know, buy like five science fiction books and go home, and I would just spend the day reading my books. And I would start reading. I like to read in a chair. Sometimes I like to read on my bed, and I would read and read and read. And you know, suddenly I would realize it was time for dinner, right? It was just totally lost in a book. I began to love that experience, right? I just love that experience of like getting lost in a book. And it almost became like addicted to it, right? It was like if I had to go into dinner and talk with my family, it was like I was just craving to get back into that book. You know, the book was so much more interesting than what would go on at the table, or at least I thought so. And I really became like this super avid reader, and people would make fun of me. My parents, my family would make fun of me. They'd say, "Oh, your nose is always in a book." You know? And you know, that reading practice is like a mental practice. You know. You focus on the words on the page, and then you enter into this visualization mode, right? And and everything disappears. Now you're in like another world. You're on another planet, you know, basically, or you're in Victorian England, or you're in Latin America, you know, some point, wherever the, And you know, you meet these people who are almost as real when you're in the book. There are people who are almost as real people, you know. So, I remember reading this book. It's four books that are called the Alexandria Quartet. They were written after World War II by this writer named Lawrence Durrell, and I thought they were fascinating. And there's four books in the series, and they're set in the Middle East just before World War II. And you know, the people in that book, they became to me like closer to me than my friends. I have to say, it was just like I could have sat and told you about these characters and everything about their lives. It was like I knew them, right? So this is a little different now with my students and their cell phones. But they're sort of going through the same thing. It's different, right? They're not reading words on a page, but you know, the practice of going on your cell phone and surfing for information is somewhat different from reading, but it has the same effects, right? It's like everything around you disappears, and it's like your concentration becomes intensely focused. And when it becomes intensely focused, what you're focusing on sort of becomes the whole world, right, for you. And this is really something interesting. It's not a mechanical process. We don't really pay much attention to these activities and how they affect our consciousness. But you know, but definitely what they do is they make us withdraw from the world, and in the case of reading, it really stimulates your visual imagination. I think the internet maybe does that in a different way, but has similar effects. My nephew, when I went to visit when he was younger, was a gamer. You know, and I remember going and staying in my brother's house when he was still alive, and for Thanksgiving, and my sister came over, and everybody came. But I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do my zazen. And I was in the room next to my nephew. And I could hear this boom, 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 boom. I thought, what the hell? You know? So, you know, I could tune it out. But later I said, what was going on? Were you watching TV? And he said, no. He said, that's Diablo. Diablo? It's this game. People are trying to kill you. You have to kill people. You get weapons. He showed me the game, and you advance to different levels, right? You have to store up your weapons or something. But it's so absorbing, right? He got up. As soon as he was up, he was in Diablo, right? He was fighting skeletons and monsters, and so real. I remember once coming back from Sesshin. We had had a Sesshin down at Murray Grove, and I was driving back, and I was driving through my neighborhood, and I saw this kid. He was like, I don't know, 8, 9, and he was walking down the street holding this long stick in his hand, you know, and he was holding the stick, and he was walking, looking very. You know, he was totally gone, right? Something was going on. He was Luke Skywalker or something, right? You know, I have no idea, but he wasn't there, right? It's just like he's somewhere else, man. He's doing something with that stick, right? It made no, and I just, I was sitting at a traffic light, and I watched him walk by, and it's just like, you know. So these are like clues, I think. To how our minds work, right? And we don't really pay attention. We're really naive about all of this, right? But you know, we have this capacity to focus on things. And when we focus intensely on things, sometimes everything around us disappears, right? And this can happen in various contexts, right? It can happen reading a book. You go to the movies, right? It's a classic, you know, if you feel unhappy and, you know, your life is going nowhere, go to the movies and you can have an adventure, you know, and you come out of the movie theater, you feel like you've traveled to another country. So I think all of this gives us a clue about how ordinary consciousness works, right? You know, I think what ordinary consciousness does is to zero in on something and start excluding everything around us. And, you know, as you get older, your concentration actually becomes more focused. So one of the reasons old people seem oblivious sometimes is that they're just focusing on one thing, right? And tuning everything out. It's very difficult for older people to multitask, I have discovered. So but it's a characteristic of us all of us. And a lot of growing up is learning how to do this, learning how to concentrate, you know? So I was kind of a dreamy kid, right? I liked to go for walks and let my imagination have free play, right? And I would go to school with my coat on and go through the day, and I would come back and my mother would say, "Where's your coat?" And I would have no idea. I have no idea, you know, where that, you know, she said, "Well, did you put it, coat? What coat?" Right. Just oblivious, right? And, you know, so it was, when you go to school, you learn how to concentrate, right? You if you were sort of a dreamy kid like me, it was very difficult to just like focus on the board, and the teacher is trying to tell you that this multiplied by this is this, right? And it's, you know, one of the things that education does is it shows you how to focus, you know. So the teacher will give you, you know, 10 subtraction problems, or, you know, every other one is a subtraction problem, and the other one is a addition problem. And you're supposed to pay attention, right? They try to trip you up. So it's like 5 + 3 = 8. You know, 8 - 3 equals, you know, and you might add it again, right? So they're trying to get you to pay attention, and paying attention is a lot of what school does. And, you know, you have to be able to, you have to learn how, even if you're resistant, to focus in, right? And it tune everything else out, and it's very, you know, it's one of the reasons kids don't necessarily like to study, right? My brother was a really good student, but he was very gregarious, and he just hated being in a room by himself, right? He just hated that. In fact, sometimes he would come downstairs, like with his math book, and just sit with everybody and do his math there, so he didn't feel so lonely, right? Didn't lose contact. Whereas I couldn't concentrate unless I cut every, you know, close the door, no noise, you know. So a lot of ordinary consciousness involves focusing, and as we get older, we're really expected to be able to focus, and focusing means, I think, pretty much what I say. You rivet your attention on something, and as you do that, it's like turning the knob on a microscope, right? It's like you zero in, and as you zero in, everything else disappears. And then you are able to sort of like completely absorb yourself in that. And a lot of education is learning how to do this, right? And And, you know, like advanced education is learning how to do this for like sustained periods of time, right? And if you think about the kinds of work that is highly rewarded in our culture, we really like people who can do abstract thinking, right? I mean, people who can stay in a state of abstraction or withdrawal from the world are like highly rewarded in our culture, right? So like, you know, philosophers, right? You can literally spend hours not engaging with anything real, just with like concepts. So you know, tremendous benefits come from this, right? I mean, you know, if you think about all the benefits that come from like scientific research, or I myself, still, I love to read, you know, you know, this has a downside as well. This has a downside, you know. This process of zeroing in, I think, has the effect of breaking our world up into little pieces, right? And so, in a way, we sort of go from one little piece to another little piece, right? If that makes any sense. You know, to be aware of something in ordinary consciousness means to tune in and tune out everything else. And we spend a lot of our time tuning in and tuning out, tuning in and tuning out, right? So, you know, when I'm getting ready to teach my classes, I'm focused like a laser on my lesson, right? And I don't really hear anything. And then I go to my class and I teach my class and I don't think of anything else, you know. And then I might have to go to like a faculty meeting, and you know, each of these is like a little world, right? Each of these moments is like a little, it's like its own little world. When you're at the faculty meeting, if you're really tuned in, your students are gone, you know, the book you're teaching is gone. It's nowhere in the universe. You're just listening to your colleagues argue with each other or whatever, you know, drone on and thinking about when will this be over. You know, when you're in class, there's nothing in the universe but your class, right? You know that. And this has, I think, has the long-term effect of making our world like very broken into little pieces, like atomized, right? And we become, you know, we go from like one little island to another little island. And when we're on the island, everything in the world seems to be an island, right? It seems to be our island. So like when I'm teaching, my universe is my class. And if it goes well, I'm elated. And if it doesn't go well, I'm dejected. And I think, how can I do this better? You know, when I'm focused on a writing project, you know, the hours go by and nothing else. And if it has been successful, I'm happy for the rest of the day. And if it hasn't, but this is like the world of ordinary consciousness. It's very broken up into little pieces. And it has the effect of very subtly breaking up our world into little pieces. It's like it's very difficult for us to see how all these little pieces connect. What holds them together is not obvious. It's as we grow up, we learn more and more to like break the world into these little pieces, and maybe ordinary consciousness just does this anyway. But it has a number of effects. I mean, by the time you're like 12 or 13, you've gotten really good at this. And one of the effects I think it has is to make everybody very narcissistic, right? It's not that anybody's to blame, but I think one of the products of breaking the world up like this is that we become increasingly like self-aware and I think narcissistic. You know, so, you know, when I was a kid, I when I was about 13, I suddenly realized that I was not somebody my classmates really admired or wanted to be like, and I so wanted to be liked. So, you know, suddenly I had to cut my hair a certain way, I had to dress a certain way. My clothes just didn't correspond to what, you know, my friends at school were wearing. So, you know, when I would be waiting for the school bus, you know, I don't know if your experience is different, but I wouldn't be thinking about anything but my appearance, right? And when I would get on the school bus, I would just, as soon as I entered that school bus, I was thinking, they're judging me, right? Oh, they think I'm not cool, or will they like me? Will they like me? Maybe I was unusual in this regard, but I think lots of people at a certain age are like that, right? And, you know, that's actually nobody's fault, and it's probably part of the life cycle. But if you think about it, you know, how strange that is in a certain way. You know, I didn't get on the bus and think, you know, there's David. I wonder what David did last night. Or, I was so focused on myself, right? And I don't think it's evil or bad, but I think it's a consequence, right, of being in this broken up world, you know. This year I had the chance to teach this wonderful novel called Middlemarch, which is 1,000 pages long. It's a really long novel, but it's such a great novel. And one of the things that the author, this woman, Marianne Evans, who wrote under the name George Eliot because it was hard for women to get published, shows in the book is how people are all very egotistical, and gradually they learn that other people have a world too, right? It's so beautifully done, right? Because she's not critical of her characters. It's like they're all caught up in their own heads. And, you know, eventually, you know, when you're 13, the universe, you know, you'll hear your mother say, the universe doesn't revolve around you. but actually, when you're 13, you think it does, right? And it's, and everything is about you, right? And George Eliot, you know, she shows these characters sort of breaking out of that and discovering that other people exist, right? It's a real discovery. It's like, oh, you know, you have anxieties too. How? I had no idea. You know, I thought you were cool. I had no idea you were worried about whether you were cool or not. I assumed you just lived coolness, or you lived beauty, or you lived intelligence, right? And she shows that when people are able to get out of themselves and identify with others, right, it's really liberating for them, right? Because we're all living in this prison. We're all trying to be liked and admired, and we dare not really connect with other people. We're so afraid, right? So she shows this happening. It's so beautiful. Anyway, this is our, you know, from a certain standpoint, this is our problem. You know, it's very difficult not to live from one, to go from one little island to the next little island. Because consciousness, you know, ordinary consciousness creates islands. You know, we have an incredibly naive understanding of consciousness. You know, most people think that they see reality as it is all the time, right? Of course I see reality. What else would I be looking at? And Buddhism teaches that people rarely experience reality, you know? That Buddhism says, you know, actually to be encounter with reality, not one in a million people do that. Right, actually, or not one in 100,000, right? It's very hard to achieve connection with reality. because we're in our heads, we say. But more than that, it's not just our heads. We're in the ordinary consciousness creates these little silos, right? It creates these islands. So, you know, basically, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Queen's Gambit. It's a series, rather. If you haven't seen it, it's very engaging, you know. So sometimes after I've graded papers, I will come downstairs and I was watching some of this series, Queen, and it's about a young woman who grows up in a orphanage. And, you know, she has no human contacts. It's really terrible. She's very lonely. She never develops a normal emotional life. But the janitor at this orphanage is a chess player. And she's, you know, she becomes this world champion chess player. This is how she learns how to interact with people, right? So you know, chess becomes her world, right? It's like she's able to zero in and enter into this mode of chess thinking, right? And to an extraordinary degree. And one of the interesting things about the story is that she's so emotionally underdeveloped, right? I mean, basically, she is, you know, she's a 12-year-old emotionally, and she's like a chess genius, right? And she's emotionally impoverished, right? I mean, and a lot of the story is about that dynamic. You know, will she ever get off her island, right? So anyway, a lot of ordinary, the mind is not a camera, you know, the eye is not a camera, the mind is not like film. That's not how it works. You know, consciousness is really complicated. And people are zeroing in and making everything disappear. And when you zeroed in, where you are becomes the universe, you know. And then you go from like one little island to the next. And that's how we live our lives. And you know, it's always astonishing, isn't it, when people are so insensitive, right? They're like so unaware of like human suffering, for example, right? It's just like, how can you not be aware of this suffering, right? And you could say, oh, they're hard-hearted, but it's more like people, concentration doesn't allow you to notice, right? There's this wonderful poem. I also taught a poetry class this spring, and we read this poem by this guy I like a lot, Auden. The poet Auden. And Auden has this poem called In the Musée des Beaux-Arts. He's wandering through a museum and he sees this painting by this guy Bruegel, by this Flemish painter Bruegel. And the painting is of a summer day, and the painting is called The Fall of Icarus. If you know anything about that story, there's a Greek myth about this boy whose father was a great inventor. The father's name was Daedalus, and the son's name was Icarus. And Daedalus built wax wings for his son to fly around on. And they worked like a charm, like in your dream. You know, Icarus would put these wings on and he could fly. And Daedalus said, now look, these are great, but don't get too close to the sun, because, you know, the feathers are held together with wax, right? So if you get too close, the wax will melt. And Icarus is like a teenager, right? So he's totally enjoying his wings, and he's also, you know, kind of a cocky and egotistical. And he flies too close to the sun, and the wings melt, and he falls to his death, right? And the painting actually is showing this. It's showing Icarus plunging into the ocean with his wings all broken up as he falls. But the interesting thing about the painting is that Icarus is not at the center of the painting. He's over to the side. And Icarus is falling to his death at one side of the painting, you know, and all this other stuff is going on. So this farmer is plowing the fields. some people are having lunch, you know, a sailing ship is coming in off the sea, and it's beautiful. You know, the waves are catching the sun. And you know, basically, pretty much everybody in the painting is oblivious to his death, right? And Auden is writing about this, A-U-D-E-N. Auden. Auden is writing about this, and he says, you know, basically, nobody notices this. You know, the Bruegel's point was, you know, we live in our little worlds, and we become oblivious to other people. And Auden thinks this is a big problem. The poem is really saying this is a big problem. And he wrote it just as, like, World War II is breaking out, right? So he's kind of saying, the day of Normandy invasion, when, like, you know, 70,000 people died, and a lot of people were just having a picnic, you know, they, you know, so he's saying we too easily create these worlds in which we become unaware of the predicaments of other people. And it's not that you're evil. It's just this is part of concentration. This is part of the way we construct our mental worlds, our islands. So each of the people in that painting is on a little island. The farmer's plowing his field, and he has a beautiful ox. You know, this handsome ox is pulling, you know, and the farmer has these beautiful clothes on, and the lovers are kissing, you know, the ship is coming in. You know, basically, concentration does that. So this koan, believe it or not, is really about that problem. It's about the problem of living in the island creating aspect of concentration. And, you know, Buddhism is actually very interesting. This is like a central issue. Because, you know, by the time we're 45 years old, we pretty much go to the same islands all the time. And the areas between our islands become like unknown territory. And we grow comfortable with our disconnections, right? But our world is very fragmented and very disconnected. So this koan is really saying this is the big problem, right? This is the big problem. So, you know, you can't solve this problem by concentrating more deeply. Isn't that interesting? So this is not a problem that can be solved by concentration. If you have never heard Philip Glass composition before, you know, if you listen to it, you concentrate on it, everything will happen just as I said. You know, you will listen to the Philip Glass music, everything will disappear except the Philip Glass music. You will have found a new island, but you won't have gotten off your island, and you won't know how the islands fit together. So this is the problem the koan is trying to address. So Umon, Master Cloudgate, a monk asked Umon, "What is the Dharmakaya?" Now, you know, basically, if Umon said the Dharmakaya is such and such, he's telling the student, concentrate. See, concentrate. But he says, no, don't concentrate. He says, the Dharmakaya is beyond the six. Now you might think, what is the six? Well, this in Buddhist thinking about the world, there are six senses, not five. So we say, you know, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling, but in India they said those five, and then thinking. They actually thought of thinking as a sensation, like smelling. So it's always, in Buddhist literature, it's always the six senses. Right? So he's saying, the student says, what is the essence, what is the Dharmakaya? And if Umon had said, just concentrate, that would be a fatal advice, because no amount of concentration will ever help. You know, you can study the sutras forever, and you can't get off your islands, because the sutra study, even though we're going to resume it in the summer, and it's very important, it puts you on an island. It doesn't get you off the island. So concentration won't do it. What will do it? See? And that's really the challenge for Buddhism in general, for meditation in general. How do we not concentrate and create these little islands? Right? And if you think about meditation practice, you know, basically it isn't about concentration, actually, right? So you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you concentrate on your breath, right? It's very interesting what happens, you know. Actually, after a while, sooner or later, the breath will disappear and your mind will be blank. See, now this is like, it may take a while. You know, people sometimes practice for a long time before they notice this, right? Because they're concentrating on the breath and they're concentrating and concentrating. But that does not liberate anyone. Right, actually. So a lot of people think of mindfulness this way, right? Mindfulness is about bringing your mind back to the present moment. But actually, the present moment is also an island, right? So if you're noting, right, you're practicing awareness of moment, and you hear the fan, and you notice fan, and then you notice like pain in your knee, pain, then pain in your butt because you've been sitting on the cushion too long. Then you notice fan. Then those are like islands. That's not solving the problem. Not solving. Each of those is a disconnected island. See? So how do we get off the island? And when we do meditation, we start to get off the island, but it's not in the way you might think. It's not through concentration. If you watch the breath long enough, your mind goes blank, right? And actually, now you're off, I would say, now you're off the island, right? You know, that blank mind is refreshing for some people, and it's frightening for some people. Some people dislike it, right? Because they want an island, they want a terra firma, firm ground under their feet. And you know, especially if they are they're comfortable, you know, with things that are firm and they can hold on to mentally, right? That kind of fuzzy mind is very difficult for them to cope with. It's like a fuzzy mind. It's a drifting mind. So years ago, I had a student who he was a linguist, and he was a wonderful guy. But you know, his progress in meditation was inhibited by his desire for this like firm grasp. Right? So he was working with breath perception, and he would come in and say, he'd say, Kurt, you know, I'd say, how's your, his name was not Joe, but I'd say, Joe, how is your meditation going? And he'd say, I don't know, I don't think I'm doing this right. And I would say, what do you mean? And I'd say, describe what's happening. And I'd say, oh, that's wonderful. And he said, no, I just don't think I'm doing this right. You know, is my mind really blank, you know? And he was he's a lovely person, and it took him a while to overcome this. He's not the only person who I have encountered in Zen who has this. It's like he wanted something to hold on to. So he would say, you know, I just don't think I'm doing this right. Meaning, give me something to hold on to. You know, some people like things to be crisp and clear, like doing math problems, right? So you sit down and if you have to do math, you know, you have to pay attention. You work towards a resolution, everything disappears. But, you know, Zen involves a kind of like ambient awareness. It's not focused awareness. It's like this ambient, unfocused, almost like fuzzy awareness, right? It's not a dream state. It's not ordinary consciousness. When you're in Muxin, it's like there's you're in a kind of like drifting state, right? And that is like that's one way to describe the connections between our islands. You know, our islands are all connected by this ocean of emptiness, you could say. When I was practicing Zen in Seattle at the Seattle Zen Center, I was so stuck in my Zen practice. And I would go to the Zen Center and come back on the bus. And one day somebody, you know, this is before people had earbuds. You know, long ago, people had to, if you wanted music, you had to have a little radio with you, like it was called a pocket radio, right? And then when I was in graduate school, there were what were called boom boxes. People would have these large radios, and they would turn them on in public and upset everybody. So on the radio, I was on the radio coming down from Capitol Hill, down to the U District where I lived, and somebody had the radio on. It was playing the Police, and it was Sting said, "The connecting principle has to be invisible," and it was like, "Oh shit, you know, that's great. I think I'm getting what this Zen is all about, right? It's like, of course, you know, of course, the connecting principle has to be invisible. You know, as soon as it's visible, it's an island, right? We do all the things I just discussed. You know, when we get into Muxin, now we're in this blank ambient awareness. You know, a few years ago, I was reading about martial art, something on martial arts. I'm a big fan of like Chinese martial arts movies. I'm a big Jet Li fan, for example. And of course, Donnie Yen as Ip Man is breathtaking. Right? So, you know, I think it was an interview with somebody like Donnie Yen, and he was saying, you know, in his martial art, right? He said, you don't focus. You know, you don't focus. You have an ambient awareness. Because it's like if you focus on somebody's hand, the other hand is already going to knock you out. So it's like you don't focus. It's an unfocused, like holistic awareness. It's really like the art of not focusing. Because if you focus, you're already trapped right on your island. You have to be able to move from island to, it's not just about throwing blows, right? The other person is engaged in like creating a context, and you have to respond to that change of context. And in order to do that, if you're stuck in the old context, you're not going to be able to do what Donnie Yen does in Ip Man, and that is not break any pots in the house, any of the fine china while you're holding off your opponent, right? You're holding the china in one hand and you're knocking him cold or on the other, right? You know. So anyway, I heard that and it really resonated with Zen practice. It's really like that, right? As soon as Lin Ji calls this, you know, you don't want to get, the mind shouldn't get stuck. Don't get stuck. Don't create an island. Or don't stay on the island. You know, as soon as you get stuck, you're stuck, right? So the idea is to maintain this ambient, free flowing awareness without getting arrested by anything. And you know, things arrest us because they trigger clinging, right? So So, you know, if something happens, we begin to solidify our concentration. It takes a center, and we become defensive or fearful. Whenever that happens, now we're back on the island, right? You know, that free-flowing concentration that doesn't have any center, it doesn't allow us to be attached or to be fearful, right? Those are all symptoms of island dwelling, you could say. So this is about, you know, we become, human beings are like these great, we're like dolphins who are stranded in these little ponds, right? And our home is the open sea, but we don't know, you know? But to practice Zen is to go home, to be where you really belong. You know, we really belong in the deep sea. We're really like these great aquatic beasts, right, who are trapped in these little rubber swimming pools that we create for ourselves. But to practice Zen is to return to our true nature, right, and be these formless beings and live in this formless world. Engo's introduction. Heaven never speaks. See, heaven doesn't, words are islands, but heaven doesn't speak. Yet the four seasons follow their courses. See, the connecting principle is invisible. Earth does not talk, but all things prosper. Where the four seasons follow their course, you can see their substance. Where all things prosper, you can find the use. Now tell me, where do you see the monk? Stop your speech, your actions, your daily routine, and closing your lips and throat, say it. So it's beyond words, right? Beyond the six. A monk said to Yunmen, to Cloud Gate, what is the Dharmakaya? He said, beyond the six. Secho's verse, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Even the blue-eyed Indian monk cannot count it. Rashly, they say, Shorin passed it on to Shinko, or he, clad in the robe, journeyed back to India. So, basically, this is Shinko was the guy who cut his arm off, basically, to awaken. And he didn't go back to India. India is vast and far. He is not to be found. Lo, since last night he has been here facing Nyoho. So please don't get stuck on your island. Please keep practicing this beautiful path, and we'll be free together in the ocean of emptiness.